Hello and welcome to What the Flick. We are still at my dining room table and we're still What the Flick.
Hello and welcome to What the... Oh, wait.
Hello and welcome.
Sorry, that's my new... Well, as you guys know, that's been my voicemail forever.
Right. Yes. That's Matt Atchity.
Yes. Hello.
And who else is here?
I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
I'm still Christy Lemire. This is still my house. It's a very special afternoon edition of the What the Flick podcast. Nick is home from school and ignoring us on the couch on his iPad.
Also, breaking news. Quiet. I've just now decided that the we're going to change hello and welcome to Movie Phone to aloha and welcome to...
Why?
Because of the Hawaiian.
Yeah. Oh, it's your Hawaiian shtick. It's your ethos.
No, maybe not.
It's cultural appropriation.
I feel uncomfortable about this.
Okay, then I won't do it.
There's a lot to talk about today. It's a really busy day because we are deep in the throes of award season at this point.
It's a packed week.
We are, but I want to start off with a weird, interesting story.
Please.
If that's okay. I had lunch with my uncle who was one of the people who is responsible for the Meg.
Who is he?
Really?
Ken Atchity. He is a literary agent and has shepherded a lot of some movies, and that's one that they've been working on forever.
Hmm.
And we had lunch today, and we were talking about things, catching up, and he said, we talked a little bit about Rotten Tomatoes, and he says, how involved were you with the script reading aspect of that? And I said, what? And he said, I'd heard that there was something where you could send your script in to Rotten Tomatoes and they'd tell you how to fix it and they'd give you a potential score. And I said, what?
It's like the Black Mirror,
like,
dark underbelly.
There had better not be. Why wouldn't you have told me this while I was still there?
And RT blacklist.
Right. And I thought, maybe he has to have that wrong.
Maybe it's a different website, not yours.
Right. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there is somebody out there with that name doing it. But, you know, not my problem anymore.
Or maybe just somebody saying, like, here's what this script would get at Rotten Tomatoes.
Right. I mean, I could see someone floating around saying, hey, I've got these 20 critics, and they're all tomato meter critics, and they'll read your script. Like, I mean, that would be shady, but I could see.
That's a scam.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, whoever you are, show yourself, imposter.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
We want to know.
That's some rotten behavior.
Interesting. So let's start with First Man, because it is the biggie of the week, as we are deep into award season. This is the latest from La La Land and Whiplash director Damien Chazelle. He's brought back his whole technical team from those films. Who's going to describe it? Matt, please tell us about First Man.
I will describe it in more detail than Gabriel, my 15-year-old, did, because I told him the other day, hey, I'm going to see the First Man. And he says, is that the one about the moon? Yes. That's all it's about. The moon. First Man is primarily focused on Neil Armstrong and his work in the space race and in the astronaut program, and as he was part of the Gemini project, to the precursor to the Apollo missions, and kind of the work he and a bunch of other astronauts put in before we had our first moon landing. The movie is as much about the failures as it is the successes. And you get, you know, kind of his days back when he was doing X-15 test flights as an engineer, and you get a lot of his home life. In fact, as much of his home life, I think, as you get him on kind of doing anything at NASA. And, you know, spoiler, I won't spoil anything, but, you know, I think the ending's relatively satisfying.
They make it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think the biopic stuff of Neil Armstrong is fairly standard. It's like, you know, he's driven and he has tragedy, but he overcomes it. And, you know, and that's all fine. And Gosling is giving a very, very stripped down, sort of walled in performance, which is, I think, appropriate for the character. I think what the movie does best is convey the terror of space travel, because, like, even in the right stuff, things don't feel as rickety as they do here. Like, this movie, you really get the sense, like, oh yeah, you're just like stepping into this like collection of bolts and metal that some other dudes put together and just hoping for the best.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we kind of take the idea of space travel, like,
for granted.
For granted, right? And the way I think about this, what this movie, this was kind of, you know, you don't feel this, I didn't feel this in Right Stuff, I didn't feel this in Apollo 13, but in this particular film, it's, you know, and I'll say this in kind of the parlance and metaphor, to use a car metaphor, I have a car that's about 6 or 7 years old, a German car, and it will happily do 100, 110 miles an hour. My 30-something-year-old Mercedes that you guys might remember, when that went 100 miles an hour, it was like, oh, God, we're all going to die. Right? And it did it, and it was built to go on the Autobahn, but, boy, it was a much different experience. And so you're watching, like, you never lose sight that this is like, oh, this is 1960s technology.
Right.
And, oh, yeah, like, it's as if these guys, like, it's buttons and dials and switches and, like, oh, my God, I can't believe these guys actually went up in this stuff.
Yeah, it is as stripped down and as bare bones and restrained as La La Land was lush and over the top and swoony. It's like the total opposite movie. I mean, he has gotten together with Ryan Gosling again and with the same cinematographer, Linus Sandgren. Tom Cross cut it. Justin Hurwitz did the music, so it's a lot of the same team. It is really impressively crafted when you consider that they didn't use green screen.
Wow.
Yeah, oh. And a lot of it is intended to give you the sense of claustrophobia that they must have all experienced, yes. Right? Because you are inside like a sardine can, and so much of it is so tight. I brought Nick, and he's maybe going to chime in, I'm not sure, but he had a hard time seeing what was going on and always understanding what was going on because so much of it Right. Put you in that headspace, put you in that tiny capsule, feeling just how shaky it is and how disorienting. And it's intentionally trying to make you feel that way. It's kind of hard to, you know, see all the time, but it's effective in conveying that sense of panic and fear.
You know, I didn't feel like the right stuff really does this, and Apollo 11 doesn't quite do this either. You feel like those guys are wearing those capsules. Right? Like, when they get into that spacecraft, they're not getting into it. They're putting it on.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, there is no space. And you start, you know, especially compared to watching Apollo 13, where they're back and forth between the LEM and the capsule, and you're like, eh, yeah, no big deal. They got plenty of space. This one's like, oh, God. Like, they, you know, when you see, there's the scene where Aldrin and Armstrong are putting their suits on and like they have to maneuver around just to get out the door.
Right.
And you realize like, oh yeah, these guys are in something that's like maybe the size of a closet,
right. If
that. And they have to put these suits on.
You know, and like Apollo 13, this is a movie that generates suspense even though we know how it's going to turn out. But I think it's also important because it's, you know, for those of us who were born in the late 60s and beyond, like landing on the moon is just a thing that has always happened. And we always knew it was possible because it happened. But before they did it, there were any number of things that could have gone wrong, any number of reasons why it wouldn't have worked. Like, you see that the president had a statement ready to go, like, in case they landed but didn't come back, you know. And it's just one of the things. It's sort of like, you know, a movie I love that I will drag up in all kinds of conversations, 1776, you know. We assume that the Declaration of Independence and the sort of the American fight for independence against the British as a done deal. But before it happened, nobody had done it yet. And so it was like, what, are you crazy? And so to capture what the feeling of that not having happened yet is like in a movie, I think, is really exceptional.
And they do a good job of creating a sense of what the nation's reaction is and what the world's reaction is, right? It's not just, it's a very intimate portrait of a man and a wife and a family.
Yes.
But also they do a good job of suggesting that this, as you say, was a huge deal at this time, a thing that we now take for granted.
Yeah, and not just the reaction of the landing itself, but, you know, it takes years of experimentation and failures to get there.
Right.
And you get the public reaction to that too. It's not just somebody running down the hall like you get in Right Stuff, like, oh, the Russians did this and oh, the Russians did that. It's like you get, you know, very valid questions.
Yeah, like Kurt Vonnegut on a talk show saying, like, wouldn't this money be better spent making a habitable New York?
Right.
You know, there's a whole segment.
And arguably, he's not wrong.
No, absolutely. There's a whole segment that's done to Whitey's on the Moon, which wasn't actually recorded, I think, until after the moon landing. But, you know, it does kind of raise that thing of, like, there was all these, you know, the inner city was burning and inhospitable in the late 60s. And here we are spending all this money to go to the moon. And should we have?
Here's my quibble with the movie, though, is I think it is technically excellent. And you really do feel that terror and it makes you have a new appreciation of what these guys were doing. And like, oh my God, I'm up, you know, when the one Gemini piece, you know, kind of flips out and, you know, you realize, oh, these guys have zero safety net at all. Right. But throughout his life, Armstrong was so stoic and so reserved, and I don't feel like you still ever get that much that you see. Like, I still didn't come away from this with an understanding of what really drove him aside from like, well, this is the thing I'm going to do. And that's fine. I'm not complaining about that. It just, I think it didn't quite grab me as emotionally as, say, something else.
I think that's what Claire Foy's job in the movie is, to sort of humanize him and sort of, you know, make him talk about stuff. And I love, there's a scene where she forces him to talk to their two sons before he takes off for the moon landing. And as the kids are asking him questions, he has the same look on his face like when he's at a press conference. Right. And getting questions he doesn't want to answer, you know.
I mean, I'm sure part of that is just that's who he is, and that kind of steeliness made him ideal for this job. He was the leader that they needed him to be, because no matter what happened, he was going to maintain that sense of, like, leadership and quiet, calm reserve. And also, I wonder if part of it, too, is just generational. You know, I mean, men did not talk about their feelings at this point in time.
The one guy asked him, like, you know, goes out and he's like, do you think I came down here because I wanted to talk?
Yeah.
which is a great line.
Yeah.
But again, like, it doesn't give you a huge emotional connection, which, again, like, that's not necessarily.
No, but it's hard to convey that kind of thing to an audience when you're playing a guy who is that.
As opposed to, you know, and I know we keep comparing these other two movies. Right Stuff, I felt more of an emotional connection to those guys, you know, and maybe some of it is just that generation of actors. And same thing with Apollo 13, like, partly because you get those guys, you know, the three astronauts in Apollo 13 start sniping at each other.
Right.
Right. In a big way. And I think that helps. And you really, like, feel the tension from those characters in a way that you don't necessarily feel here. And the other thing, too, is Buzz Aldrin comes off as a jerk in this movie.
Oh, I think
it's hilarious.
I love Buzz Aldrin.
It's hilarious.
He's played by Corey Stoll.
Who's always great.
He's one of my sort of favorite supporting characters. There's a deep bench of really good character actors in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Christopher Abbott.
And Karen Hines.
Yeah, yeah.
Shea Whigham's in it.
But, as for Gosling, I think what he's called upon to do is so stoic that it kind of reminded me of his performance in Drive.
Right.
Yeah.
Or Only God Forgives, which is also very dialed down. And it's a little frustrating to knowing what he can do, and certainly he should and can play every kind of role, but you do feel frustrated watching him operate just in this one note, given that we know how much more he is capable of. The thing that finally does convey Neil Armstrong's mourning or his grief or any emotion at all happens on the moon, and it's quiet and it's poignant, and I'm glad that that image exists, because you need that dearly to humanize him in some way.
I didn't do much research, but I found myself wondering how much of that was
accurate. Is that true? Who knows? Also, a conspicuous lack of American flags on the moon.
Okay, come on. There's, you know, I started watching for that. There's flags all over that movie.
There are so many flags. It's hilarious. Yeah. It's such a non-story. But you could, if you were wanting to seize on a sense of patriotism in this film, you absolutely could do that, you know, very easily.
Also, if you're a real NASA nerd, there's a lot of Easter eggs for you. Like, I was looking at some of the pictures of those guys. There's a shot of, like, the Gemini crew eating breakfast that looks exactly like the photograph that somebody took of that same thing happening.
It did bother me. They kept saying Gemini.
Why do they do that?
I don't know. I always thought it was Gemini.
I thought it was, too.
I've heard people say, though, it's kind of an old-fashioned pronunciation.
Yeah, Claire Foy is great, as always. And, yeah, you desperately need that sense of, like, being our conduit as a human being into this world and into his world.
Her accent slips a little bit occasionally.
I kept thinking, she's going to get locked up in the asylum. And it's all going to go silent.
Everyone's going to think she's crazy, but she's not.
She's insane.
I was impressed they managed to work a dance scene in.
Yes. She definitely has, like, an Oscar clip scene when she yells at Kyle Chandler.
Yeah, yes. Kyle Chandler's in it too. Yeah,
yeah. No, the supporting cast is great, and that's where it does match up with these other two movies we keep referencing. It is a very deep bench. You know, I can't remember the guy's name, but the guy who plays the Riddler in Gotham, is in it.
Corey Michael Smith. By the way, if y'all need to see 1985, which is opening next month, he's so good in that.
Yeah,
okay.
I think this is absolutely worth seeing on an IMAX.
In spite of a lot of shakiness.
I saw it in Venice, you know.
Don't they have IMAX in Venice
I don't know, but they didn't. That's not how they showed it to us. It was a big screen, but not IMAX.
We saw it Christopher Nolan's preferred IMAX theater at Universal City.
Ew.
So we all had to go there. You know, like, what were they screened? Interstellar, you know.
I didn't see Interstellar there, but I did see Dunkirk there.
This was the rare movie seen on an IMAX screen that it didn't bother me that much, that it was so much handheld camera work. It is a lot of handheld camera work, and it's done from the point of view as if you're like you're another person in those rooms, as opposed to something that's more objective and sitting outside.
And the moon stuff is shot on IMAX cameras. Is that what
it is. You can tell when it expands. It is really overwhelming, and so the stuff on the moon is so cool. The score is so great. Right. The use of silence is so great on the moon.
Yeah, we'll let everyone know that when it gets silent on the moon, that's the way it is on the moon.
It's quiet. And on the moon, no one can hear you
don't
scream.
Don't start yelling that the sound has gone out, because it hasn't.
No.
Nick leaned over to me. He's like, "Mommy, why is it quiet?" I'm like, "Shh, it's the moon."
when the movie started, I did want to start chiming, "Moon, moon, moon."
Do not start singing Barbara Streisand's "Woman in the Moon" from the 1976 A Star is Born.
Oh. Well, everything goes back to A Star is
Always,
Born eventually.
Yes.
So what are your numbers then? I'm saying 7.9. I am totally dazzled by it technically. But yeah, it's a hard thing to get a hold of him emotionally. It just felt a little disappointing to me in that regard.
8.5 more for the sort of visceral sensation of the danger of those missions than for any particular insight into Neil Armstrong as a human being.
Yeah, I give this an 8. I'm with you guys.
Okay, our number is an 8.2. It is at 90% on the tomato meter. So, yeah, I know this is something that I say a lot on this show, but see it on the biggest screen you can find. Best sound, biggest screen. Don't wait for this for the airplane.
No.
This is not something you want to see when you're in the air.
No.
Jesus, especially that opening scene in the X-15.
Oh, my God. All right, let's do The Oath. Speaking of patriotism, let's talk about The Oath. Matt, let's describe that.
All right, so The Oath is about an alternate universe, which is pretty much exactly like our own, except that the president, who is unnamed, has decided that everybody in the country ought to, they're not required to, but ought to swear an oath of fealty to the president, and not everybody wants to.
You've got to sign it. It's a physical
thing. You've got to sign it, and then everybody's got a year, and as it's the day after Thanksgiving that everybody's going to sign it, and as Thanksgiving approaches a year later, we see this family wrestling with this dilemma, and as the more kind of obviously conservative-minded people come over, things go sideways, and it gets bonkers, and it's sharp, and then it starts to lose it. But I liked this a lot.
The first half is so good and so sharp and feels like, yes, this is a movie about right now. This is a movie about what's tearing us apart and why we can't talk to each other anymore. And it's not even like... And it's very ecumenical about making fun of the left as it is of making fun of the right. And then it just goes so soft and wobbly and really cops out on the ending, which is really frustrating because it's so sharp for so long, and then it just kind of collapses.
This feels like it was made in someone's living room over the course of a weekend and largely improvised. And not in a good way. I don't mean that in a good way. No, I mean, ideologically, I appreciate where they're going, and it could not be more timely. You absolutely could imagine that this sort of thing would happen. And Ike Barinholtz wrote and directed this. It's his directorial debut. If you follow him on Twitter, he is very political. So this definitely comes from a place of, you know, an idea he cares about and a progressive voice that he wants to convey in every possible form. Right. So he's on brand here. Yes.
Ike Barinholtz is definitely a hardcore Young Turks viewer and probably member.
Oh,
I mean, the character he's playing in this.
Okay. I see.
Right.
Yeah.
This character is absolutely a Young Turks viewer and subscriber, member.
But Barinholtz is sort of smart enough to understand the foibles of being on the left these days and being kind of a knee-jerk, like, constantly angry and frustrated progressive. And so there's humor in that, and there should be. You know, it would be dull if the whole thing were just like, oh, the conservatives are so stupid and we're so smart. But, you know, he also doesn't let the conservatives off the hook either. But, there's such great setup, and then once it gets to actually having to sort of commit to something, they really just find a way, the safest, softest way out, I feel like.
But even just throughout, like, I feel like if you're going to set a movie in any one location, right? This entire film takes place in this house.
Right.
I mean, there's a brief early scene at his office with a coworker of his. And then there's some stuff out in the driveway. But really, the bulk of it takes place in his house.
Right.
I feel like if you're going to have that kind of claustrophobic setting, the writing has to be super sharp. And it feels really lazy. And again, I'm not offended by the proliferation of profanity, but it feels like a crutch and it feels like a frequent improvisational device. Mm. Like they just didn't know where to go with their words to convey the feelings of frustration with each other that are mounting. It just felt kind of sloppily put together. Again, it's his first time making a movie.
Yeah.
A lot of times the camera was in weird kind of distracting places, like over someone's shoulder at a dinner table with like weird amounts of hair
right.
halfway covering part of the frame. And it's just, I think a lot of it is like first time filmmaker stuff.
Sure.
And I appreciate that he is doing this and that he has a point of view and he has something to say and it is tackling topics that we are all talking about now. But it just felt sloppy overall to me. And yes, and the ending is a total cop out.
Yeah. I mean, it is very much a first film in those ways.
Yeah. I feel like this movie is, you know, a little bit more work, some or maybe a lot more work. This movie had the potential to be something like Get Out. Which
sure.
there are, because you get these, you know, musical interludes, which make it feel like it's a horror movie sometimes, and it's trying to put up this sense of dread, and there's hints of that there. And the stuff that he's saying and the way he feels, I bought into that. I thought Tiffany Haddish was really good in this, and the supporting cast I thought was really good as well. And the betrayal that he feels by his family members signing this document, you know, the predictable ones even, that I bought into a lot, but even as, you know, when things start to ramp up and you get Chekhov's gun, I still bought into that. And I think it's the execution. Like there's a point at this movie again, where this could have tilted into something much more horrific, but still maintain its comedic edge like Get Out does.
Sure.
And I think part of it is that Barinholtz just didn't manage to execute it well. And that's frustrating because I think you could have had something that was as sharp and almost as impactful, and it doesn't go there. And
no. And also, why is Mark Duplass in this movie?
Jay
Duplass.
Name that Duplass.
Like his character spends the entire time in a sick bed. It's like,
yeah.
Why were you here?
I don't know why. No, I really like Tiffany Haddish in this. I like that she has the opportunity to stretch.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be
right.
easy to always only put her in that wacky supporting role,
right.
like Girls Trip, which made her a star, and there's clearly more to her, and she wants to stretch, and she can stretch, and so
yeah.
that was exciting to see. It's an inspired bit of casting. Carrie Brownstein's always good.
Billy Magnuson's always good.
Yeah.
John Cho
is very good in this. Nora Dunn, who I know you're a fan of, Alonzo.
No, I wanted
yes.
more Nora Dunn.
So yeah, there are these pieces, and the intent is there, but the execution is frustrating over and over
yeah,
again.
Yeah, it's a promising film, but it does not nearly match up to its potential.
Okay, so what are your numbers?
I'd set a 5. I mean, I kind of sort of split it down the middle because I think it's good for a good chunk of the movie, and then it just deflates.
Yes. Matt?
I give it a 6.5. I liked it more than either of you guys did.
I'm saying 4.8. So our number is a 5.5. It is at 81% on the tomato meter. That seems high.
Yeah, I would again, you know, you can get a fresh tomato and be like, it was okay.
It's like enough 2.5-star reviews.
Yeah. I would certainly be interested to see what Barinholtz does next as a mm-hmm. director, but this one does not really necessarily. You know, a star is not born.
No, I like him. I liked him in Blockers.
Oh, no, as an actor,
he's an interesting
he's terrific.
Presence.
Yeah. No, I enjoy his work. I just, as a filmmaker, he's not there yet.
Okay. Moving on to Beautiful Boy. Aww. Mm. Timmy, he's so beautiful. Tell us about him, Alonzo.
So this is a true story. It's actually based on two memoirs. It's based on the memoir by David Sheff, who is played by Steve Carell, and his son Nick Sheff's memoir, who's played by Timothée Chalamet. And basically, David is a successful freelance writer. He writes for like Rolling Stone and the New York Times Magazine and, you know, has this lovely house in Marin County. and his son Nick. Even though Dave and his wife, who's played by Amy Ryan, are divorced, he has custody of Nick. They're very close. They have this really strong relationship, which is why David is somewhat taken aback when Nick starts using drugs, and not just like pot, but he's using crystal meth. And, you know, starts disappearing and has to be put in rehab. And then he escapes rehab and relapses and goes back again. And it's this whole sort of ongoing cycle of trying to figure out, you know, how to fix Nick, basically. And, I think the thing with the movie is you kind of realize there's only so many ways to tell an addiction narrative. And this one doesn't really necessarily find new and interesting ways of doing that. Chalamet's great. He gives a really powerful performance. Carell is okay. This is, you know, this is the first of two films we're getting from him this award season of him, like, trying to really make his mark as a dramatic actor. We've got Marwan coming out before the end of the year.
The feature version of Marwan Call.
Right, or the narrative version. He was good in Foxcatcher, but here he sort of is in two modes, which is either, like, hangdog or shouty. And the thing is, and also because, like, so much of it is set in this beautiful Marin County house, and it's just like, could this be any bougier?
Well, I'll tell you what. There's a section. So I used to work in Marin County. I was the police reporter for the Marin Independent Journal.
Ah.
Yes, my second job. And that depicts quite vividly a very specific kind of remote woodsy Marin. Because it's like way the hell – it's like Inverness. It's like way the hell far west. Like, it takes a long time to get there. It's very far off of the 101. You got to really know where you're going to get there. And so I feel like the sense of place with the house, with the beach, is one of its strong points. Because it is – and then they do go into San Francisco quite a bit when Timmy needs his drugs and he's, you know, sad and rain-soaked. And Steve Carell had to go and seek him out and try to understand him and all that. I hate the way this film is edited. I hate the narrative structure. I found it really distracting and really distancing because the director, Felix van Grenningen, I'm probably butchering his name, he also did...
Dr. Man from Chins.
Yes. He is Belgian. He also directed Tom of Finland. And... He did Broken Circle Breakdown. I'm sorry. I'm confusing with a different film. He did Broken Circle Breakdown, which also had a nonlinear narrative structure.
Yes.
So... what's frustrating is Timothy Chalamet and Steve Carell will have these really powerful moments. You know, as father and son, they clearly have a very strong bond with each other. And then for whatever reason, really needlessly, there are all these flashbacks and flash forwards.
So much jumping around in time.
And so you'll see Steve Carell sitting in an airport waiting area. It's like he's for a red eye. He's by himself in the middle of the night and... he's taking a red eye somewhere, and you don't know whether there's a thing that's already happened, whether there's a thing that we're flashing forward to that he's going to have to do when he gets a phone call. And over again, they do this. And is it to invoke or evoke, rather, their sense of inner chaos and turmoil? When they do the flashbacks to when he's a little boy, they, you know, create a sense of nostalgia and melancholy for the promise that this kid had. He was a lovely, bright kid. When he is in high school, he's, like, wise beyond his years, and he's into all these poetic depressives like Bukowski and Kurt Cobain.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yes, and he loves music that his friends don't love. He has, like, really cool, cutting-edge tastes and everything. He's an interesting, smart kid. They establish that he gets accepted into all six colleges that he'd applied to. Like, the future is all there. So the flashbacks establish, okay, this is a kid whose fall is that much more dramatic because he had everything in front of him. As we see from his woodsy paradise, he's got, you know, the financial means to be fine.
Right.
He'll be fine. But more often than not, it's really distracting. And that is why my number is what it is, because it mucks up what is good about these performances. I mean, Timmy is James Deaning the shit out of this.
Yeah.
You know, it's deep and tormented and twitchy and charismatic, and you can't stop watching him. Like, all the promise of Call Me By Your Name, you know, it's all there. It all makes sense. And he and Steve Carell have fine chemistry. And actually, when you see him like side by side, it's pretty good casting.
Yeah,
the eyes and the nose are very similar.
Yeah, you buy them as being, you know, related. But yeah, I mean, he's definitely magnetic. You can't stop watching him. Carell didn't really grab me. Maura Tierney, I think, is sort of an underplayed, underappreciated MVP in this movie.
Let's talk about both the women in this movie, because you have Maura Tierney as his second wife and Amy Ryan as his ex-wife.
Right.
And neither of them really gets to do very much.
Maura Tierney
has one scene toward the end.
Yes.
But Amy Ryan is pretty much relegated to phone calls. She's down in Los Angeles.
Right.
You have these two really strong actresses, and it's not about them. It's about the men. I also hate the soundtrack. There are so many cringe-inducing, painfully on-the-nose song choices throughout this film, including this sickly sweet Perry Como cover of Sunrise Sunset.
Oh God, that was the worst.
When
like, you cannot do that song. You have to either be like super ironic, or like it has to just work perfectly, because otherwise it just is such an obvious like commercial touch.
It's,
you know,
so literal. And then what else? On Neil Young, Heart of Gold, and then they play a song from Nirvana, Nevermind album, Territorial Pissings, to show off, you know, when he's like an angry young man.
Yeah.
But there's a line in that song about, you know, just because you're paranoid don't mean they're not after you. I mean, there's like the song lyrics in these choices are so on the nose all the time. It's so overbearing. Yeah, Steve Carell pulls off of the road in like middle of nowhere West Marin to just stand outside of his car and think and be sad, and they're playing, "Is this the love I care?" it takes you out. There are so many choices here that take you out of this vividly constructed bubble they've created.
And for a movie that's based on two memoirs, you might think, oh, okay, well, maybe then we'll get like some scenes that are clearly, you know, one point of view and one that's the other, but not really.
It's mostly Carell.
It's mostly Carell's point of view, and it's mostly just kind of a basic, you know, omniscient narrator for the most part. Like you don't ever get the sense, like, as much as I like Chalamet's performance, I never felt like he got sort of a monologue or a something to really kind of, and not that I wanted his addiction to be explained, but I just wanted this character to feel like he's expressing himself and this is where he's coming from. And you never really quite get that.
You'd get it from his journals. When Steve Carell,
when the dad
sneaks into his room and reads his journals, you see him expressing, you know, his self-doubt and the fact that he uses to, and then he's remorseful about it, and then he uses more
because he feels bad,
the pain of that. Addiction's a hard thing to depict cinematically because it's so internal, and its reasons are varied. And I mean, they hit some of the notes that you see quite often in addiction films. There's a scene where he and his girlfriend break into his parents' house to steal stuff to buy more drugs. I mean, you have some of the standard things that you see in addiction films.
Yeah, there's definitely tropes, but I think ultimately with addiction stories, it's like either they get better or they don't, you know, or there's not a lot of different ways to do it. And this one doesn't really seem to find anything that doesn't feel real familiar.
Yeah. So what's your number then?
I said 5.5, and that's almost entirely for Chalamet's performance.
I'm saying 5.8. So our number is 5.7. It's 69% on the tomato meter. So if you are a fan of Timmy, I guess go see it for him. Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. More than seeing Hot Summer Nights, sure.
Right. Speaking of amazing casts, Bad Times at the El Royale. Tell us about that, Alonzo.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm not going to get into spoiler territory, so I'll just keep it real vague. So it's set in the early 70s?
69, I think.
69? Okay, yeah.
69.
Hey, dude. It is this motel that has seen better days, that is situated on the California-Nevada border. In fact, the line divides the lobby down the middle, and you can choose to stay in the California side or the Nevada side.
So it's the frumpy version of the Calneva Lodge from way back.
They're exactly. In Tahoe, yeah. Are they in North Shore or South Shore of Tahoe? Do we ever figure out?
I have no idea.
Okay.
So anyway, a motley crew of guests arrives, including John Hamm as a vacuum cleaner salesman, and Jeff Bridges as a priest, and Cynthia Erivo as a singer. You'll be seeing a lot more of her. She's in Widows, and she's going to be the lead in that Harriet Tubman movie that's being made. Mm-hmm. Dakota Johnson as a woman who seems upset and angry about something. that's about all you need to know.
In the beginning. And then, well, then there are other people in the cast that we know are in the cast who show up eventually.
Yes. But other people arrive. Agendas are revealed.
Things happen.
Mysteries about the hotel itself become apparent. And, you know, what will happen?
Right. Written and directed by Drew Goddard. So if you saw Cabin in the Woods and enjoyed the twisty puzzle of Cabin in the Woods, this is another twisty puzzle, and it takes so long to solve.
This movie reminded me of, okay, remember in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory when they go on the Wonka-mobile? And it's this huge, beautiful, elaborate vehicle that you have to pour all of this like soda pop and stuff into it. And ultimately, it travels very slowly and goes about 10 feet.
Yeah.
That's this movie. It is this, like, super complicated puzzle box of interlocking revelations and surprises and twists and turns that ultimately means nothing.
Did you like it, though?
I was mostly entertained while I was watching it. And then by the time I got toward the end, I was like, oh, that's all this is going to be mm-hmm. then. It was like, hmm. As time wasters go, it was okay. He is good at this sort of thing. It's not as good as Cabin in the Woods, which I think had things to say about, not just about movies, but about sort of society and how our lives work in a lot of ways. This just sort of felt like he was just kind of showing off narrative tricks.
Yeah, I don't know that it has anything to say. It takes place during a period of time in American history that is, you know, notoriously volatile. And he kind of addresses some of the cultural iconography of that time with one character.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm going to say. But yeah, I don't know that there's a whole lot of a point or insight. It is a blast to watch.
The set decoration is on point.
Right, yes.
That hotel is amazing.
Every room is really cool. Oh, and there's the opening with Nick Offerman is very cool.
Yes.
It's all one long shot. That's all I will say. And that's pretty cool, too. The script is fun. The costume design is fun. Mm-hmm. I love everything that Dakota Johnson and Cynthia Erivo are wearing.
The performers are enjoying themselves.
Yes. Cynthia Erivo is just magnetic as hell to watch. Like that voice. She opens her mouth and this really powerful voice comes out. She sings a lot of Motown songs in this. And she's just a blast to watch. It really wears out its welcome.
Yeah.
It's 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
Yeah.
And does not need to be.
No.
And stories, there are like tangents within tangents and like anecdotes and flashbacks and stories that just go on forever to give everybody their backstory.
There's a moment in the movie where you think, okay, finally we're getting somewhere. And it's like, nope. we got another flashback. I'm like, oh my God, now we're going to Vietnam? What? You know, so yeah, it bites off more than it can chew, but, you know, you have to, at a certain point, sort of admire the balls of it all, you know?
Lewis Pullman, is he son of Bill?
I don't know.
He looks exactly like him.
Oh, maybe he is. He's really good. He plays the bellhop.
We're going to look it up while we're talking, yes. Yes, he is son of Bill. He looks just like him, yes.
There you go. That makes sense.
Ironically, he's adopted.
It's fun and frustrating, and I'm recommending it, kinda.
I think this might be a good one to watch at home, except that you kind of have to pay attention to it.
And it's so great looking, like
it, that's
you
true,
should
yeah.
look because like it's so deeply steeped in period detail,
yes.
almost like a really heightened version of our memory of that period.
Yeah.
Like in the greens and the oranges and just the decor of the room.
The analogness of everything.
Yeah, and the decor of the lobby. A lot happens in the lobby and it's like impeccably detailed. So I think you maybe need to see it on a big screen or see it at home on a big TV.
Right. it's funny. You and I will be voting at the end of the year for the LA Film Critics Awards, and this is a contender for me for like art direction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if
we
nothing,
do have that category, don't
if,
we?
If nothing else.
This and First Man for all the rickety capsule.
Exactly.
So my number is a 6.2.
I said a 5.9. I'm like just shy of going fresh on it. But, I mean, it has things going for it. Just it collapses on the weight of itself.
Yes. There's a character I really want to talk about, but we probably shouldn't.
No.
There's a sexy meme out there involving a character. and that is, for me, the moment of the movie. A sexy meme involving a plate of pie.
There will be, yes. There will be memes.
And there already are. There actually already
really?
Are
of, oh, funny.
Of that image that I'm talking about.
I didn't see the movie, but my parents lived in the El Royale apartment building on Rossmore, and that's nice. I'll give that a 5.
That is a beautiful building. It's a historic building on Rossmore. You know where it is?
The apartments aren't.
The
apartments aren't great.
Are they not?
But it's
cool building.
It's a cool building. Overall, I'll give it a 5.
Interesting. All right, cool. So let's move on to a movie that's on Netflix that has been out for what, like a week or so?
Yeah, it dropped last Friday.
Okay, it is called Private Life. I will describe it. So Catherine Hahn and Paul Giamatti are a married couple in their 40s. She's in her early 40s. She's like 41. He's like 48. And they are both writers. They're like in the writer, playwright, theatrical world in New York City. They live in the East Village and have been there for a long time and have been happy there in their community, in their work, and they decide they want to have a baby. And they have trouble having a baby, as so many people do. And this is about that struggle. And it's about the emotional highs and lows and the medical lengths to which they are willing to go and what happens when they decide to rely on somebody close to them to help them conceive, and the seeming ease of that, but also exploring the complicated emotions underneath it. And that's hormones talking, that's, you know, expectations, that's a sense of like panic, like self-imposed panic that sets in when you reach a certain age and have not had a baby. Some people can have a baby. I have a girlfriend who had a baby at 42 and they weren't even trying. I have a friend who had a baby at 45 and wasn't even trying. But that's really unusual. You know, usually when you get past 35, you got to kind of get your act together and, you know, make that baby. I was 37 when Nicholas arrived.
Yeah,
it takes a long time sometimes.
I have a sister who's 43, and she's got a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old.
Okay.
My mom was pushing 40 when I was born, but I was the 7th, so, you know.
Right. So it does happen, but sometimes it takes a lot of work and a lot of money and a lot of hope and a lot of sadness. And so this is about the ups and downs of that process. Tamara Jenkins wrote and directed it, and it is so beautifully observant. The script is just hilarious, and it is heartbreaking and so true. Catherine Hahn is amazing in this, and yeah. I really hope she's in the awards conversation. I know that, like, you got big, showy performances from people like Lady Gaga and Glenn Close, and this is more understated and more, like, steeped in, you know, day-to-day honesty, but, she kills me in this.
She's great. Kaylee Carter, who's a relative
she's
newcomer,
so good.
Plays their sort of, like, niece by marriage. She's the daughter of Molly Shannon, who's now married to Giamatti's brother, played by John Carroll Lynch, and she steps up as somebody who might become an egg donor for them, and you know, which further sort of complicates the familial ties and whatnot. But yeah, it's just about this couple and what the stress of this process does to them and their relationship and how they weather it together. And you know, I'm a Giamatti fan from way back, and you know, I think this is one of his better performances. Yeah, this is just a really sort of smart, this movie feels very observed. Apparently, Jenkins went through a lot of this herself.
It seems very personal and very detailed in the intimate moments of it. You know, the unglamorous, unromantic medical processes here.
Absolutely. And just like the way that, like, you know, when you're going through a lengthy medical procedure, how, like, some doctors will talk to you like you're an idiot, you know, that sort of thing. This is a really, it's really sharp, it's really smart. And Jenkins is so great. I wish she's one of those filmmakers like Nicole Holofcener where it's like, why don't we get a new movie from you like every 2 years?
Like every 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, she hasn't made one since The Savages. So.
And that was 2011. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess if she's going to take her time and give us something really beautiful and really
true, I'm not complaining.
I'll wait.
I'll take what I can get.
Molly Shannon's really great in this, mm-hmm. unsurprisingly. She was great in Other People, yes. which we both loved. And people react in different ways to this plan that they all come up with.
Right.
And that comes from a place of great truth as well. The fact that people don't always say the right thing in the right place at the right time, and they let their own emotions get in the way when it's really not about them. And the fact that it gets really emotionally complicated, I very much appreciate. It also manages to depict a very specific kind of New York and a very specific kind of New York creative community without being like Woody Allen-y at all, or without being, adorable and twee, or without being, smug and ironic. It's just, it is,
because they
it's very open emotionally.
They live like very much the East Village. So like in a decidedly ungentrified corner of Manhattan, mm-hmm. A noisy and sort of maybe still a little dangerous one. But at the same time, they have this beautiful apartment and this loft. And at one point, like the niece says, this is like an ad for assholes. I like this movie a lot. And so it's on Netflix. You can see it and you should.
You can see it. It is 2 hours long, but it really breezes by. It's quite moving and quite lovely. So yeah. I'm saying 9.3.
I said 9.
Okay. Our number is a 9.2. Is it 93%? It's very good. And then finally, hey, Nick, you want to come talk about Goosebumps 2 with me?
No.
Okay. So,
this is for you.
So there's another Goosebumps movie for those of you who keep track of these things. This is Goosebumps 2 Haunted Halloween, which seems redundant to me because are all Halloweens not haunted?
Not as much as this one.
Okay.
It seems to be belaboring the point.
Arguably, I would say that it's the day before the actual haunted day, right? Because the Day of the Dead is the day that everybody comes back, right? Like
But All Hallows Eve.
All Hallows Eve, it's like, oh, well, we want to ward off the spirits because they're coming tomorrow.
I don't know. You've given this a lot more thought than I think anybody else has.
It's like when people show up early for a party, you're not ready yet.
All Hallows Day is the feast day of, like, where the ghosts.
Yeah, those birthdays, yeah.
Yes.
Now, did you guys see the first Goosebumps from a few years back?
No. I did.
Okay, and what'd you think of it?
It was fine. I like a decent, like, kids scary movie. First of all, that's about my level of scare, because I'm a total coward. But I think it's fun to have movies that will give kids a little bit of a jolt, like Frankenweenie or, Paranorman or whatever.
Frankenweenie is great, though. Frankenweenie is, like, beautiful and technically impressive. Yeah. I'm not sure this is that. This is directed by Ari Sandell, who is an Academy Award winner for Best Live-Action Short, was it? For West Bank Story, yeah?
Yes, and he did The Duff.
He did The Duff, which we really liked.
It was fine.
I like The Duff a lot. It's quite charming. So this is basically about Slappy, the ventriloquist dummy who comes to life and is voiced by Jack Black. So Slappy was a supporting player, a small supporting player in the original Goosebumps movie from a few years back. It's kind of like the Minions, right? Kind of like the Penguins of Madagascar.
He got a promotion.
The Slappy gets his own movie this time, pretty much. And so, so it's different kids. It's different place. A couple of good friends played by Khalil Harris and Jeremy Ray Taylor. They find this creepy old house, which apparently was R.L. Stein's original childhood home. It's all dilapidated, but they find a book. And they find a key to open the book. And, of course, they shouldn't, but they do. And, of course, they say the words that are in the book and then repeat them, which, oops, happens to be a spell that conjures Slappy. And Slappy is...
Didn't they say Evil Dead 2?
No one
never does.
These things... It's weird because this very much is part of the Goosebumps universe. Like, it is kid scary and people make dumb decisions. But no, you think they'd be a tad more savvy than that. No, they say the words on the piece of paper.
I guess because no one in that Goosebumps universe hears about anyone else in the Goosebumps universe.
So they can't compare notes.
It doesn't make a sound.
Right. Right. Because if they'd heard these other stories, like, oh, you know what? Let's not.
When you find that book, just leave it locked.
Hey, I think I can pronounce this. No. Maybe you shouldn't.
No, but at first, though, having Slappy around is kind of cool because, like, he can use his mind to do your chores and do your algebra homework that you don't want to do. And he can, you know, pull pranks on the bullies who have been mean to you. And so he's kind of like a really helpful sidekick at first. But then, like, you sell your soul to Slappy. And you end up having to do his bidding. And when these kids won't do that, all hell is unleashed upon this small town.
Kneel before Slappy.
Yeah, pretty much. And this is a town where people go all out with their Halloween decorations and costumes. So Slappy does something that makes them all come to life. He like turns all the pumpkins and all the spiders hanging off of people's houses and
Sergeant Pumpkin.
What is it, honey?
Sergeant Pumpkin.
Yeah, Sergeant Pumpkin on the front porch becomes an actual like pumpkin seed spitting warrior. And there's cute stuff in it. It is cute and it's amusing. The effects
Sergeant
aren't
Pumpkin
great.
Related to David Pumpkin?
David S. Pumpkin. Call him by his name.
Bibbs reviewed this for me at the Wrap and he said that the best thing about it was Wendy McClendon Covey.
Right. So she's the mom of Madison Eisman, who was in Jumanji. Mm-hmm. And Jimmy Ray Taylor plays her little brother. She's a single mom. She's a nurse. And she's kind of just like trying to take it all in stride. And she's got to work a double shift at the nursing home and has no time for Slappy shenanigans. And yeah, she's always good. And so she can be funny, but also like be the anchor of this and, you know, be our conduit into the insanity of all this. Ken Jeong is the next door neighbor who does insane front lawn Halloween displays, including one of the better sight gags, whatever you want to call it, is he has this giant spider covering his entire house and made up of individual balloons, like little bitty balloons. And so when that comes to life, it becomes like this giant kind of Harryhausen-ish creature that wreaks havoc on the town. There's also a really cool bit with some gummy bears.
But it's balloons, right? So you could just go after it with some needles.
And
yeah, the gummy bear part's cool. Yeah, you could go after it, but I think maybe they're fortified because he's now been turned evil by Slappy. I like your thinking.
Right.
But he sticks around for a while, the evil spider.
He's smarter than you, man. Sorry.
We've thought of everything.
See, because I'm thinking about in the Goosebumps universe and where paranormal things happen, at some point there's somebody doing the equivalent of the NBC, the More You Know things. Like, hey, kids, when you find this ancient scroll, don't open it.
Somebody on Twitter was saying that so many of the Goosebumps, you know, tropes or characters got unleashed in the first movie that it was like, what was left? You know.
Well, okay.
I never read the book, so I have no idea.
I never read the books either, but Jack Black, who is R.L. Stine in the original movie, has a very, very small part here. It's like they had him for a day. Mm-hmm. And he shows up for like a day to say his lines and then was also in the booth being Slappy. Yeah, you know what? It is fine. It is a totally fine, scary kid movie. It's not super scary. I think little kids would be freaked out by some of the stuff coming to life. But this is like solid 8-year-old, 9-year-old scary movie. It's
slumber party fair.
Yeah. No, it's like the fun to be scared kind of scary movie. It's not great. It's not terrible. I'm giving it a 5, just right down the middle. You could do worse. There are worse Halloween movies out there.
And it's on the tomato meter.
It's on the tomato meter. Oh, it's at 30%. I don't think it's that bad.
I didn't see it. I once had Gabe convinced that Goosebumps were a allergic reaction to geese. When Gabe was like 4 years old, he's
like on your body?
Yeah. So when Gabe was like 4 years old, he's like, I don't know why I have goosebumps. I said, it's because you're allergic to geese. He's like, what? I said, it means there's a goose nearby. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, well, geese chase kids and kids have this natural allergy. So it's this defense mechanism. It's a warning. And he's like, well, you don't have them. I'm like, well, geese leave adults alone. Wow. And so later that night, he's got goosebumps again. He's like, oh, yeah, I guess there's a goose nearby. And his mom says, what? He's like, yeah, that's what Matt told me. She's like, that's not what that means.
That's so mean.
It was awesome.
How are you allowed to adopt this child?
You're mean. Anyway, so recapping, we talked about First Man. We give it an 8.2. The Oath, we give a 5.5. Beautiful Boy gets a 5.7. Bad Times at the El Royale gets a decent score at 6.1, and Private Life at 9.2, and I'm giving Goosebumps to a 5.
So yeah, see First Man big, and see Private Life in the privacy of your own home.
Yes,
on
you can. Next week, speaking of Halloween, next week is Halloween, you guys. Jamie Lee Curtis is back.
No, that's like 3 weeks from now.
No, it's not.
Oh, the movie.
You mean not the day.
The movie. Ah.
You are on fire today. Wow. I'm not going to pee to put you out.
Next week, we have Halloween, which I hear is actually really good. We have some more potential awards-ish stuff, at least indie awards-ish stuff, with Wildlife and Mid-90s. And Can You Ever Forgive Me with Melissa McCarthy, which is at 100% currently. Ooh. So it could be a good week next week. So stick around and stay with us. Anything you guys want to add as we leave?
No, just thanks for everybody for all the positive feedback on Twitter. We appreciate it. And we are having discussions about what's happening next. And there is a next. And once we have it all nailed down, we'll tell you all about it.
We will.
Yes.
We've been having talks.
Yes.
All right.
Over breakfast.
Breakfast. Thank you guys all so much for listening and for being great and for sticking around. We will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.